Today, I welcome Catherine Tackley to the In Conversation With podcast for women in jazz media. Catherine is a musicologist and academic. She holds a PhD from City University and is currently Professor of Music at the University of Liverpool. She currently holds a major research fellowship from the Leverholm Trust for the project The British Dance Band, Music and Musicians in the Mainstream, and is on research leave until autumn 2025. Oh my goodness, I really had to read that last bit, Catherine, because I don't really know all about that bit. But it is lovely to have you on my podcast, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about that, actually.
An absolute pleasure.
How are you? How's autumn going?
Yeah, autumn's good. It's half term, isn't it? So that's something that a lot of us have to juggle in one way or the other. So it's a nice autumn, and I feel, yeah, I'm in the second year of that big project that you mentioned that I think, yeah, perhaps we'll chat about a bit later on. But so I feel sort of quite settled into things just now in terms of kind of what work means at the minute, which is a little bit unusual compared to what it has been. But yeah, it's all good fun. All good fun.
Yeah, because you already have 3 books out, don't you? And then this hopefully will become a fourth, or will it be more?
I was talking about it to somebody the other day. It's like, oh crikey, there's so much in this. It's just write 2 books. It's, oh goodness, yeah, that definitely one more, definitely one more. I think always when you're doing a big project, there are little sort of side avenues you can go down that then end up sort of sometimes then taking a life of their own that might become, it could become another book or might become an article or something of that nature. But so this would be the fourth, my fourth book, but my third as a single author. And possibly I think this is heading towards being quite big, actually. the more I work on it, the more interesting stuff I find. So it's sort of expanding, but definitely in a good way. So yeah, very, very, I'm very, yeah, very privileged to have the opportunity to do another really big project. I'm very much enjoying it.
It must be big. How many years have you got off for it?
I've got 2 funded years. So the Leverhulme Trust, they're really generous, actually, and they give fellowships actually for people at all stages of their careers. But there's this particular grant that is really, I think it's sort of aimed at basically people that are relatively senior and have done a lot of leadership and management. And one thing that happens in higher education that basically our jobs involve teaching, research in most cases, but not necessarily all, and the sort of admin bit. So everyone has a sort of admin bit, and sometimes that admin bit ends up sort of taking over, and you still want to do some teaching, or I certainly wanted to do some teaching, and then it's a sort of the research stuff, which it does just take time. It you need time to think, you need time to often physically go to places and get stuff and look at things, and it's that tends to sort of disappear. So the Leverhulme is really generous in giving people that have had lots of admin time to really spend on that. So that's what I'm working on at the moment. And then I'm also really generous in that, really lucky in that work are then giving me another year, which they give to all heads of department when you finish being head of department, which adds up to 3 years altogether. So that's a nice, really nice amount of time to really get stuck into something big. So that's where I am at the minute.
Oh my goodness, that's so cool, isn't it? I got 6 months with my grant.
3 years would be nice, wouldn't it? Yeah. No, it's really, you know, it is, I'm very well aware it's like a once in a career thing. So I'm using every minute of that time to get the very most out of it that I can. This will probably, in all probability, won't happen again. So yeah. Very lucky.
I mean, I the listeners won't know, but actually I know you from a teenager. Yes. When we used to play together, and you are extremely organized and you are extremely hardworking. So I have no doubt that you will make the most out of this.
Oh, that's very kind. And I'm even more impressed that came across from when we were very much younger and larking around with saxophones and clarinets. Now you're doing it properly and I'm still larking around. But I'm very happy with that as well. Yeah.
So I was, well, just as you were, I hadn't really thought about this too much, about the whole research thing, because I started, when I went to Trinity, I actually started on a master's And I started doing the research. I was just like, oh my God, this is just not my thing. So I changed to be a postgrad and then an advanced postgrad in performance. And I used to have to go to these, well, I went to the British Library a few times. So I just felt dizzy in there. Like, it just wasn't my space. I didn't feel like it was my vibe there. And yet, I wonder how you have to get prepared. Do you have to get kind of psyched up to go and do that? Or how does that work?
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because we all just gravitate towards these spaces and ways of working that really suit us. So I can't imagine doing what you do, although probably at one stage perhaps I could have learned to do a lot of the things you do, and I do them, as I say, in my sort of spare time. But yeah, for me, the British Library is my happy place. It's where I did a lot of my PhD. We're talking about the newer British Library. Some of your listeners might know the older one, which is now part of the British Museum, which is very, very beautiful, sort of round reading room. I just missed that. They just moved to the new building, which is just between King's Cross and Euston. And actually anyone can go in, and actually anyone can get a reader's ticket now, but also you can go in and see the exhibitions just for free. And some of the things they've got as sort of free things you can just go and see are amazing. So they've got some Beatles lyrics like on the back of a sort of postcard sort of thing, and some amazing old manuscripts. I think they've got an old sort of autograph of, I think, Handel Messiah, and some old, very old Bibles and sort of old Shakespeare things and whatever. So it is fascinating. But what's wonderful about the British Library is it's basically a legal deposit library. So everything that gets published basically goes there. So you know they're basically going to have everything that you need. And it's like magic. It's like something out of Hogwarts, you know, that you place your order in and then these books sort of appear from around. Well, actually, they're stored right underneath the British Library, and they come up and you go and collect them, and then you can read, you can read them. And I suppose when I was a postgraduate in London, I just used it like a library. So I was in there every sort of research day, and I would finish the pile of books and I would order the next pile up. These days, because I'm not based in London, also I have to be more organised. But still, you can order stuff up and then go down and see it. And what's lovely about it also, you end up bumping into like loads of colleagues and friends and perhaps people you hadn't seen for ages, like being at a gig or something, really. And you're like, oh, I haven't seen you for ages. So that's one. It's one of the many places that I end up going to read. But yeah, happy place for me. It can be quite daunting, though. I appreciate it for other people.
Happy for you. And it just induced a headache in me. I had to exit quite quickly and go and get a coffee.
Yeah, it is a bit overall, just the scale of it and everything. It's just, yeah, it's great. I tend to use, there's a humanities reading room upstairs that's a little bit smaller, but also they've got a lot of the sort of jazz books, discographies and that sort of thing are just on open access. So that's really great when you're just like, I just need to go and check that, or I just need to grab that off the shelf. So I tend to be up. I've told everyone where I am now, haven't I? That was silly. But that tends to be where I am. That's a nice space to do everything I need to do in there when I'm down in London. Yeah.
Have you been to the National Jazz Archive? Do you ever use that?
I am, in fact, a trustee of the National Jazz Archive. They
sent me a few emails, but I haven't got back to them yet.
Oops. Oh, the great bunch of people. Yeah, the National Jazz Archive. It's in Loughton, which is actually, it's in Essex, but it's right at the end of the tube line. And they've got just the most amazing collection of jazz books and all sorts of archival holdings, like full runs of all the old magazines, so Melody Maker and Rhythm, and a lot of the more obscure ones as well. And yeah, lots of volunteers are amazing there, and they're digitizing and sorting out everything. And it's great. And they're actually started a lot of live performance there as well. So they've taken over another part of the building of the library in Loughton, and for a jazz hub, which is now a little bit more of a sort of extended home, to put on some gigs, to put on talks and that sort of thing as well. I've been going there for quite some time now, and it's lovely because they always help me out. Normally it's when you do, you know, you shouldn't do this, but you know, there's the odd thing where you haven't properly written down the page reference or something or whatever, and I have to quickly get on the phone to David Nathan in the archive room there. David, please, can you just check this for me? That's a fantastic resource, really. And again, worth checking out because so much of it is digitized and you can just consulted from your home, from the your living room, or from your desk. So that it, we're very lucky to have that, especially, you know, because most of my work has been in British jazz, looking at British jazz history, and there's the weird and wonderful in there, definitely, as well as all the standard stuff. Yeah,
see, that's the one place that I was all right, because I did my dissertation there. I did the arrangement techniques of Gil Evans in the Cool Period.
Oh, that is literally very cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And David Nathan was there. So this was a long time ago. It wasn't online, you know, nothing was digitized. So he and I used to go through all the old journals and things. And he, I don't know if he still does, but he used to have a lovely drawer of exciting sweets.
Yes, David's sweets are legendary.
And I would spend many days in there scoffing sweets and looking at journals all about Gil Evans and Miles Davis.
That's a very, it's a very cool topic, actually. It's a very cool topic. It's such a neat, unique sound, that as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, David does still have his sweets. So it's,
I don't, he's suppose, still I, there. Wow.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, he's still doing that fantastic job of just making everyone feel comfortable and welcome. Because I have worked in a lot of archives, and I'm sort of getting back, obviously, to doing that now. And they all have their own sort of idiosyncrasies and their own sort of ways of working or whatever. And one that I'll be going back to soon is another one which is really quite small. Actually, when you go and visit it, is a BBC written archives, which are in Caversham. And I remember when I first started going there, there was strictly no eating in the reading room. It was very, very strict. But someone would come round and they would kind of ring a bell, and then we'd all go out and have a cup of tea, you know, or a cup of coffee and a biscuit. And that was great, because you would obviously just head down, working in silence, whatever. And you get to meet just the other random people that happened to be there researching BBC at the same time as you. And all sorts of interesting conversations would come from that. But again, I don't think they probably do that there anymore either, but again, it's a real absolute treasure trove there of interesting things to look at and see, and some quite shocking sort of statements about jazz back in the day, and it wasn't very well liked, let's say. So yeah, lots of really interesting things to read there. Yeah.
And with that one, the BBC, do you have to book your time, or can anybody go, or do you have to be like an official like you?
No, I think anyone can go. Yeah, you have to sort of obviously have sort of project in mind. You can't just go and say, oh, I'd really like to see such and such. You know, it's not quite like that. But yeah, it's a lot. They've got a lot of stuff, but a very small facility for reading it. So yeah, so I've had to wait a couple of months actually to get an appointment. But yeah, technically anyone can go. But yeah, it's got quite a unique atmosphere. It's sort of in a little bungalow, and you're kind of in a room, just maybe about five or six of you working at the same time. Whereas, you know, the British Library, if anyone's ever been there, you know, it's immense. The reading rooms are massive, hundreds and hundreds of people are working at the same time. And, you know, National Jazz Archive also is, you know, it's small, but it's a small room, although with the extension that's really good, because it just means that more people can work simultaneously. But yeah, so the archives vary greatly, and sometimes, you know, people are just quite happy and they just say, oh, well, I will just leave you with it then. And you're confronted with just like sort of rows of cardboard boxes full of stuff. And I think it's when you come out and your hands are black, you know, you've done a really proper day's work in an archive, just digging through all this old sort of dusty stuff. But that, you know, and just discovering things, you know, there's no catalogue or anything like that. Nothing's digitised, but it's amazing what you can stumble across. And, you know, that's a lot of fun. That is a lot of fun.
Yeah. I bet it is. It just sounds a little bit overwhelming to me.
Well, you see, if you said to me, right, get up with your Barry and do a gig at Pizza Express or something, I'd be like, yeah, no, thank you. So there we go. Each to their own.
Yeah. I love the fact that you're so enthusiastic about it, about something that I, you know, isn't my place to be. So this is great. Really lovely to hear about.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess, you know, it's sort of, yeah, I've always sort of taken a particular slant on jazz. I got really interested in jazz because I think in a way, sort of jazz as music, it sort of throws up all these really, really key issues that we should be thinking about, without wanting to kind of get sort of too serious about it. But, you know, things about, I mean, you speak about a lot on this podcast about, you know, diversity and equality, and in respect to gender and race and age and all these sorts of things, and nationality and identity, and And actually just how people relate to music. Is that about listening or playing or dancing or trying to learn to play or reading or record collecting? And there's all these different ways that we can, appreciate music. And you kind of see them all in jazz, but because it's such a short history, really, it's like 100 and a bit years, it's all sort of squashed up together in a very kind of concentrated sort of way. And that's one of the things, for me, makes it really interesting. And also that it's, there's always a level of improvisation in there, whether that's like totally free, we're not even going to talk about it, we're just playing, or whether it's actually something that is quite reliant on notation. There's still that interpretation that's so strongly there. And I think it's, everyone sort of has that, choice within the music as to how they relate to it and how they play it. And that for me is really, really interesting. And although I've written other sort of styles of music as well, I think it's jazz does always sort of stand out to me for all those reasons, really. And you can't help but be enthusiastic about it, because it's just, wow, and you discover these different kind of connections with what's going on at the world at large and what jazz is doing. And there's always some sort of connection, whether it's, as I guess the stuff I'm looking at the minute, the mainstream and jazz are very much, they're very much interlinked. And then at other points, jazz has been this really rebellious music that's gone totally against the status quo. And look at those moments and everything in between. Yeah, it's been really fascinating. And you'll never get done with it. You never reach the truth or the ultimate conclusion about it. There's always more that but that, so yeah, so endlessly fascinating, really. And a great sort of way of making your life interesting, I suppose, is to explore all of that.
So when you're researching, let's say, this new project, and you might come up and see something that relates to a previous book, would you be able to go back and like put in an addition or something to add it in?
Oh, that's a really good question. Yeah. I mean, technically, yeah, people do sort of publish new editions where they would add stuff and perhaps update things a little bit. I've never done that as such, although, if you were sucker enough to read all my stuff from beginning to end, you'd probably see that sort of things change, and there's a bit of, there's a bit of wiggle room. And it's not that what I wrote, my first book in 2005 is now wrong, but if I was to write it again, I'd probably do it differently. And B, there would still be new things to say about it. And I mean, I guess that's, my first book was about jazz in Britain before 1935. So for most people, jazz is barely not going at that point. But for me, that whole process of it evolving was so interesting. It's not just like, oh yeah, one Thursday in April there was jazz and there wasn't jazz last Thursday. It's never that simple. But I always said that there are so many gaps. There are so many things I didn't write about that you could write about. And since then, in nearly 20 years now, which makes me feel really old, but people have come along and filled in those gaps, and that's been really great. And people have come along and said, what you said about such and such, I found this and this and this, and that's brilliant. That's really good. Long may that continue, because you can never be sort of definitive about this sort of stuff. And I mean, especially with archives. One of the sources, sort of unexpectedly, I ended up using was from the National Archives, to try and get a sense of like the underground club scene in Soho in the 20s and early 30s, because by its nature, you don't find that, it's not going to be in a magazine that you can buy on the shelf, that this is where you've got to go or whatever. And you're always sort of finding out more about that. But that was like looking at police records of where these places have been raided. And then they would say, oh, and there was a band in the corner and it had five people in it and blah, blah, blah. So you could find out a little bit about that. But then, the National Archives are releasing new records all the time, and people are finding new stuff and new evidence. And it just sort of adds to the story all the time, really. So I've not actually really kind of gone back over what I've done, but I've done sort of those sort of tangential projects, I suppose, that just slot more building bricks into that sense of the history and how it all works. Yeah,
you're kind of like a music detective, Catherine.
It is a bit like being a detective, you know. It is, and it is about piecing together the evidence, and yeah, and working out how it fits together, and actually working out which bits are completely erroneous as well, because someone's remembered it wrong, or written it down wrong, or filed it in the wrong place, you know. And you can never just go on one bit of evidence, really. You've always got to find the context for it so that you understand what it is that you're dealing with. But yeah, so it's that's really exciting. And then, I mean, what I'm doing now is also just trying to bring the music into it more, not more strongly, but in a different way, I suppose, because I'm really trying to put myself on the bandstand next to those musicians that were playing in these dance bands in the 20s and 30s, but actually way beyond that as well, 40s, 50s, 60s, and even today as well. And yeah, sort of put myself alongside them and think, okay, well, they were playing a lot of this, you know, how would I have felt as a musician at that point having to do that? So one like ridiculous fact for you, I've been doing a lot of counting of how many of a particular number was recorded in the big discography of dance bands, which runs till 1945, and there were almost as many recordings of the Blue Danube Waltz by Strauss from the 19th century as there were of some of the very most popular things in the 1920s and 30s. And no one ever really talks about how much they were still playing waltzes and how much people still wanted to dance to waltzes in the 1920s and 30s. So that's a whole other, there's a whole book on the waltz there. That's definitely not what I'm doing right now. But yeah, so it's just trying to sort of think through all those problems, I suppose, and trying to bring it all together into some sort of senses of arguments and lines of thought and themes that are going to make sense to people when they read it.
Yeah, you almost need some minions beneath you to go off on the tangents and start the new projects, and then you can pick them up when you finish this one.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's another way of doing research, actually, which a lot of people, are often able to do, is that you make a sort of project team, and together you investigate something, and you might, sort of delegate different bits for people to do. And I've been part of one of those teams, and the biggest one was a project called What is Black British Jazz, which was in the 2000s, that project, when I was at the Open University with some marvelous colleagues. And we all took sort of slightly different aspects of that project, and it was at that point I started looking at a group that was around in the 30s, the West Indian Dance Orchestra, who a lot of people know about, but looking at their input, because most of those musicians had come from the West Indies, from the Caribbean, as you would expect, but also some Black British people were involved in that as well, and they were very distinct in being an all Black band at a time when really the dance music profession in this country was almost entirely white, some exceptions, but almost entirely white. And actually then just thinking about dancing a lot as well, I'm a terrible dancer, I'm an awful dancer. And I've got loads of respect for people that can dance really well, like all the Lindy Hop and the swing dancers and the Northern Soul people and all that. But dancing is just such an important part of music, and actually of jazz, and we don't perhaps think about that enough these days, that moving and dancing and having the luxury to do that is, yeah, so important. So anyway, I went off a massive tangent there, but yeah. But yes, yeah, so it's great to, it's about teams, wasn't it? Yeah, so working as part of the team, so I was sort of bringing that historical thing. There were sociologists on the team, there were people that are approaching it much more from the sort of, the notes, if you like, much more from the music, people looking at performance and that sort of thing. And that's really enriching as well, because everyone's got their expertise, and you're all sort of pursuing the same thing together and bringing that together. So that can be a lot of fun too.
Do you think that you would include like a CD or something to accompany the book?
Yeah, that would be really tempting. I think people now have started putting up sort of playlists, or having a sort of a website with with tracks on and that sort of thing. And I think that would be really great to do. I mean, I make playlists all the time for myself, because it is just, it's just brilliant with the older stuff, to have it all there in terms of reference. And I have to say, I'm so indebted to the people that collect these really old, old records, old records, and some really rare stuff as well, and are so generous with it in that they put it on YouTube. Now, I mean, I know there are questions of rights and whatever, but I mean, this is a lot of this stuff is 100 years old now, or more, so it's not perhaps quite the same thing. But it's just wonderful that almost anything I need at the minute, I can just really readily find, or actually through the community that I've begun to get to know a little bit, who've got an interest in dance bands, I can literally just say, "Has anyone got this side? Has anyone got this 78?" And if people have got it, they're so happy to share it, and that has just been such a mind-blowing experience, really, that people have got stuff that they are really prepared, to share and to lend, and also lend their expertise and everything as well. And so it's been fabulous just getting to know some of those people a little bit better as well.
Because the only reason I ask that is because when I was younger, I got bought, I think, a series of, I guess, maybe four books, and they were introductions to the Romantic period, introductions to the Classical period, and they had a little C, well, not a little, a normal size CD that slotted into the front cover. And for me, it kind of captivated me. I could listen to a bit of the story about the piece, and then I could listen to the piece in a different way. So I just wondered whether
Yeah,
you might want to do that.
I think you've got to really connect it together, because our words are not substitute for the experience of listening to the music. I say that quite a lot, and it was interesting actually. My last book was about Benny Goodman, and I did a lot of transcription, for that. And yeah, especially the solos, actually more of the solos than anything else. And I did say in the book, and I think some people missed it when they were reading it, that I put quite a lot of notation in. But I said, really what you need to do is, as you're reading what I've written about these pieces and these performances and look at these examples, you really need to listen to it, because then it will make sense. Because words, it's the famous quote, isn't it? Which I know I'm not going to quote because I can't remember it. But anyway, dancing about architecture and all of that words and music, one can't really sort of stand for the other. And now we're able to do this actually quite easily, and make that companion. And as you say, read a bit, listen a bit, read a bit. That really has to be the way. And now we've got all this stuff available. No excuses. So hopefully, when I publish it, there'll be like at least a sort of companion website or whatever. And also, I'll just make all my own playlists and stuff available to people so that they can listen and dig in the same way that I am, and hear it for themselves and draw their own conclusions as well. That's really important, I think.
Yeah, you're right. It is all about it's because if the music wasn't there, then you wouldn't be doing your thing, would you?
Well, no, exactly so. Exactly so. And as you say, in your experience, it sort of brings it to life. And do you think they were periods of music that perhaps you wouldn't have got into quite so much if you hadn't had that chance to listen to it alongside?
Well, I knew about them, but what I liked, I mean, I'm being a typical girl here, Catherine, so it was a nice hardback book with a nice front cover, colourful. And inside it described it nicely. And then it had some of the costumes they might have worn to dance it or the players. And so I kind of got a whole experience through it. And I liked that. It wasn't just kind of, like black and white in a way. It was colour and it added extra things in, which is what made me, like, I can still see one of the front covers in my head.
I think it's that visual thing, isn't it? And I think this is what I'm trying to do at the moment, is because I think in our field often, people are kind of divided into the people that deal with notes primarily, and the people that deal with context or whatever primarily. And I think more and more people now are kind of working across various co combinations of those sort of methods. So I'm not a music analyst. I work with some amazing music analysts that are totally just all over that sort of stuff. But I do want to talk about music, I do want to talk about, I mean, performance is so important in jazz and in this dance music that I'm looking at now. Actually, arrangement is really important as well. So you've got like a popular song, but someone will arrange it and make it sound, you know, completely different. And, you know, so it's sort of bringing out all those dimensions, but in a kind of contextual way as well. So it's not just taking this recording and going, well, in bar five, they do this. And then in bar six, they do this harmonic substitution, which is like, kind of, who cares? Who cares? You know, I want to know why they were doing it and what the effect of doing it was, you know, and trying to sort of link those two things together, really try and link the, yeah, we've got to look at chords and notes and, you know, improvisation and how were they improvising and you know, what was a rhythm like and what was a groove, and oh, there's so many interesting things about rhythm I can't even tell you, but anyway, but then to sort of ask why they were doing that, and often it's because, well, they were playing for dancers and dancers only really liked it this tempo, or
yeah.
They were playing for dancers and they didn't want a massive band, or they were playing, you know, for a cinema show and it had to be all whizzy to kind of get the audience's attention, or, you know, any number of reasons. So I think you've got to find the detail and ask why all the time and sort of try and cross-reference the two things. So if I manage to do that in any kind of way, then I'll be happy with this new project, most definitely.
It sounds really, really interesting. And I love the fact it's all about British dance music.
Yeah, well, you know, this started for a very practical reason, which is that I was really keen to study jazz. But at that point, I wasn't in a position, particularly for a variety of reasons, to go to America for the long term, you know, to really, which you'd need to do this sort of work, especially when talking like back in the 90s there, and then, you know, things being digitized was only really just kind of starting. So if you wanted to get in those archives, you needed to go. And then I kind of sort of realized that really nobody had written about British jazz or jazz in Britain, as they hadn't for a lot of the other countries outside America at that point. But I guess I just didn't quite realize like sort of how important that was going to be, because for me it was just like, here's something really interesting that I can do from where I am at the moment, all the resources I need, bar a few, are sort of basically here and available to me to do, and that there's a different story to be told than the, you know, very important and very well explained sort of American jazz narrative. There is a different sort of side to that here, which is this music is being imported and people are reacting to that as an import in various different ways, and they're hating it. I mean, often describe it as Marmite, actually, in the 1920s especially, people are hating this music and writing letters to the Times to say how terrible it was, but people are also loving it and seeing it as an absolute sort of godsend in the aftermath of the First World War and everything in between, people just being a bit like, oh goodness, I don't quite know what to do. And so, yeah, just a whole raft of different stories to be told. And sort of since then, you know, really that's taken off around the world. And, you know, probably most countries now, you know, do have someone there who knows, you know, that some of the particular stories associated with jazz in those countries. And that's really interesting. And I think now we're even kind of moving on to think about, actually, how does jazz move around? You know, it's not like it comes to Britain and there's British jazz, and it goes to France, there's French jazz, it goes to Germany, there's German jazz. Actually, there's a lot of sort of merging and blurring between all those as well. So I think that's kind of where we are at the moment in terms of a field of study. Of course, that makes it much more difficult because your boundaries are become very sort of porous at that point, and there's a lot more to think about. But yeah, so I was really lucky, I suppose, that I almost by accident sort of hit on a topic that then ended up being kind of the way that jazz studies went, or has gone since then. It's been lovely to be a part of that and meet so many other interesting people that are doing similar things in other countries. So yeah.
I hadn't realized there was such a community of musicologists and academics.
Yeah, it's a great community, actually. It's really really vigorous, really helpful, competitive, I think, but in a good way. I think when the chips are down, everyone's quite, supportive of each other. Lots of different ways of working, lots of different perspectives on things. But yeah, there's quite a community now, in this country, of jazz scholars. I mean, it's not massive. I mean, I think we all know each other. And then, of course, we all have particularly PhD students that are obviously also study at a high level, and they get to know each other as well. And so that sort of community grows. But there is also a sense of it being a sort of worldwide community. A lot of really, obviously, a lot of very, very interesting, very well-respected people writing about jazz in America as well, but actually all around the world. And yeah, getting together and being able to sort of talk about what we're all doing and what we've all found is, yeah, it's definitely one of the highlights of the job, really. So yeah, it's a good community. It's a good community.
And you don't find any, I mean, I think in everything there's competition, isn't there? But you'd obviously, with Women in Jazz Media, we talk a bit about the boundaries or the things we come across as females if, as performers. But I don't, is there a similar thing in your community, or is it actually just kind of gender neutral?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, if you're talking about the scholarly world in general, there's still underrepresentation at the top level. So, professor and above. And I think, yeah, in jazz, I wouldn't know the figures particularly, but there is still a male dominance, I think, in that. That's a small sort of subset of sort of musicology in general. I mean, I guess, I've always felt very, very well supported by everybody, actually, by my male colleagues. I've always worked, primarily with male colleagues, either in a sort of university department kind of context or in jazz. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely still more to be done. I think, the state of academia at the moment, it's not been necessarily very woman friendly, very family friendly. I think things are changing. It's probably too slow. And what I've always tried to do, I suppose, is to people have come to me for advice, which is great. Everyone has to find their own way. So all I can say, well, this is what worked for me, or this is what I did. And yeah, and I just think everyone's just becoming a bit more aware of, actually the job can be very all-encompassing, just like, with yours. I mean, when do you stop? When do you stop being a musician? When do
You never stop,
yeah,
do you?
you don't. And it's the same, it's exactly the same when you're thinking about things. I always got like little notes on my phone, which is just like, I'm just like, and it's, you just realize that such and such connects to such and such, and it doesn't stop. But at the same time, especially those of us that are fortunate to be employed in institutions, our jobs do have contracts and hours and that sort of thing, in a way that freelance, that does make it very, 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 very hard. And sometimes we just have to call that, and we have to say, well, look, you're paying us to do this. And that can get very difficult with the research thing, because people, it ends up being shunted into people's sort of free time. And not that they're doing it as a hobby, not that it's at that level, actually, but it almost can feel like that. And that's not fair. I think if the institutions are expecting us to produce this high level work, then they need to make time for it as well. But yeah, and that can obviously bring particular issues with it for women, as we know, because society's moved on, but it's not moved on that much in some respects. So yeah, it can be tricky, but a different set of problems, I guess, to your musician colleagues that you've spoken to. But yeah, it's hard.
Interesting. Well, at least it's on the change for everyone, hopefully.
Yeah, hope so. Hope so. Keep fighting the good fight. I mean, I have to say, where I'm at the minute, there have been a number of really good sort of female role models, and yeah, and a very good sort of attitude to all that sort of thing. And actually, very, and I've always tried, as a leader also, to try and sort of have that sort of that flexible attitude and have that support there for everyone, actually. Everyone's got stuff going on, right? And the more we can just help and support with what's going on outside the workplace, in our case, the better things will be, really, for everyone, I think. Yeah.
So when you've got all this research. I'm just imagining a room like full of paper, but I'm assuming it's not.
Yeah, you can probably see that behind me.
Then how do you go about putting that into some kind of order to then turn it into a book?
Yeah, I mean, I guess with this one, I started off with a plan, and I've still got the plan, and the plan is still more or less intact, because actually, to get the funding that's supporting me just now, you have to have a fairly coherent plan. But what I'm finding at the minute is that it's not as easy as, okay, right, I'll research chapter one and then I'll write that, and then I'll do chapter two and then I'll write that. There's a lot of spill all over the place. And at a certain point, which is definitely the point I'm at right now, that I've got like a million pieces of, like, I've got a little mini sort of post-it pile right next to me on my desk here, and like a stack of, there's stacks of books both sides, and I've got a million notes and whatever. And somehow in my head, however much I write and sort of plan and whatever, everything just has to click a little bit. And then I'd be like, okay, right, I totally know what I'm doing now. And I'm just at this point now with looking, I've basically spent probably since sort of September, when sort of academic year started again, just really immersing myself in loads of recordings and trying to work out who was doing what when. And now I've got a few points of focus, I can go into those points of focus in a bit more detail and try and then work out, so that's like on the musical detail, and then trying to work out where that's going to slot in with the various sort of themes and stuff that I've got for the book. So it's like it's got seven chapters, which are sort of different kind of themes, and yeah, it's just sort of where all that material is going to go, I suppose. So yeah, I'm right in the middle of all of that at the moment, to be honest. There's no easy way. Everyone's got different ways, you know. But yeah, at least sort of writing a plan to start with is helpful. And then you can sort of work out where everything's going to slot in.
Yeah, I imagine it must. So if you've done all that work and it's all kind of fuzzing around in your head, and then I guess organically things start to kind of drip through, and you kind of just, if things start to kind of settle, and then the roots form, and then it can mold together.
It all sort of percolates. I mean, I have to say, sort of talking to people is really good. And yeah, just in the process of talking it out, you're like, ah, I've basically just given you the abstract or the first paragraph for chapter three. I've just done that to write. I need to go back and write that down right now. So yeah, there's that sort of that process. I often find when I'm sort of sitting here and I'm kind of stuck, and I'll just go make a cup of tea and actually just go downstairs, put the kettle on, and I'm like, nope, totally got it. So the tea doesn't get made, I whiz back up, and because it is just, yeah, things just have to click together, and you need to give them time to do that. And yeah, that's what's so lovely about things at the moment, that I've not got, work-wise, I've not got too much else to worry about, so I can just be my work time, and yeah, a lot of my other time as well, but especially my work time, I'm totally focused in just trying to get everything to click and sit together. And what are the basically what I don't know at the moment about everything is, what are the arguments I'm going to make, what are the key points for each chapter, but more of those are coming into focus. So ask me again in a year. Hopefully they'll all be in focus then.
Yeah.
But I'd imagine in some respects it's like, you know, sort of planning an album, isn't it? And you've got your ideas, and then you've got more ideas, and then some of them like sit by the wayside, and then you've got to work out what order it's all going to go in and everything. And so there's multiple times that you have to kind of go through the same process to get something that makes sense in the end.
Yeah, I've just sent my album, it started being replicated today, and you just look through the notes and you look through this, you look through that, you think, yeah, it's fine. Oh no, that isn't right. Oh yeah, it's never ending, the checking, the revisiting, the self-doubt.
Yeah. Oh yeah, always.
Yeah,
always.
Someone contacted me on social media today and was saying something, and I saw he had a band, and I said, is that what you're doing? He said, yeah, but sometimes I'm just full of self-doubt. And I replied and said, that monkey often visits me.
I think it's healthy, really. I mean, obviously, if it gets excessive, then that's not great. But I think, yeah, actually sort of questioning yourself. I mean, if you go through any kind of project going, yeah, this is great, this is all great. And actually the hardest thing to do is to kind of, yeah, read back over your own stuff and critique it, and sometimes pull it apart again and put it together. And making yourself do that with your own stuff, it's kind of easy when it's a student. You're like, no, that needs to go there, that needs to go there. But also, you know, you reach this degree of independence without, yeah, I mean, we all still have mentors and people that guide and support us and whatever, but essentially it's up to you, isn't it? And that's quite daunting. You're making all these decisions and then going, oh yeah, but should is that right? You know, so it's yeah, I think we all need to kind of admit to a bit of that, but probably makes the work better a little bit of that.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. We're coming to the end of our chat, Catherine, but I've really enjoyed it.
That's gone so fast. You've asked really amazing questions. Thank you.
Oh, that's okay. Well, I'll tell the listeners a bit more how we know each other, because it would have been boring at the start, I think, if they hadn't heard you. But Catherine and I first met, we were in the National Youth Music Theatre Band. We were not on stage.
No. And we never will be.
We were in the pit band in the darkness, eating sweets, reading magazines, and playing for the musicals. But we did many musicals together, and so that's how I met Catherine. And we had a reunion for an amazing composer who wrote a lot of music for that company, who just passed away, David Neild. And and so we got chatting again, and I thought, I know, let's get Catherine on the show.
It's just like old times, really, but without so many sweets, really. We just chat forever. But yeah, I mean, I think, we're both sort of playing at that point. And I mean, you've gone on to do amazing things with your playing. I'm still playing a little bit, and it was lovely to do that, but yeah, I've still got my own band as well, so it's got a big band, and they're part of actually this whole research process in many respects. So when I was doing Benny Goodman, I was like, right, we need to play these things, we need to see how this goes and whatever, and we need to try and make it as much like the record as possible, because I really want to know, like, sort of what they were doing in terms of articulation, vibrato and whatever. Obviously you can listen to it and pick that up, but when you put it in front of musicians and then they sort of play it and you're like, oh, well, that doesn't sound very much like it. So what's wrong? All right, you need to play shorter. You need to match vibrato, fast vibrato, whatever. So they're wonderful. And that band's 20 years old now. So that's great. So that I like to keep my hand in doing that. One day perhaps I'll do more. But especially getting back to the pit work, pit band stuff as well is super fun. It's super fun. And I guess, yeah, from those experiences, it was like a love of musical theatre there, which is like I've started writing about a little bit as well, which is because it overlaps so much with jazz. A colleague of mine had a fantastic network on actually those intersections between musical theatre and jazz. It's amazing, amazing people as part of that. And so I've just written a chapter for him about jazz musicians that played in pits on Broadway in the 1930s, which was just amazing. And because we always forget that even jazz musicians like Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman, Gene Krupa, at some point they had to earn a living and they were playing in the pit bands, you know. And so that was amazing. But yeah, I love musical theatre. I'm a real sucker for it. So yeah, it was good times, wasn't it? It was good times.
It was good times. It was a long Sunday, wasn't it, when we did that thing the other week, but it was good
it
for
us. It was very good. It's very good.
I've got two Hannah questions for you, Catherine.
Oh,
I know, the look of serious just came across your face. Okay, the first one. What would your desert island disc be?
Oh crikey. Oh my goodness, that is so difficult. Because it really could be anything, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Really could be anything. Let me think what it could be. You know, the thing that's popping into my head, and this is a really, really weird choice, but it is just something that I just tend to go back to. And I go back to Bruckner 7. Bruckner's Seventh Symphony. Now, this is going to be very controversial. I mean, it's not jazz anyway. But I really like Bruckner. A lot of people really hate Bruckner, but it's one of those composers. It's all very, very slow in a sense. You know, there's not. It's not like wham bang. You know, da, 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 like Beethoven. It's just very slow, and you just have to be incredibly patient. And I love Mahler as well. And there's just so much detail and stuff in there. And Bruckner is just like it's just this sort of long sweep, and it's just like yeah, just wait, just wait. Just wait, just wait. And we played that symphony at university, and yeah, it's always stuck with me. And it's one that I always go back to. And that I think there's so many different ways of bringing that piece to life. I could have chosen many others, but yeah, I'm going to
Nice.
choose that one.
Yeah, good. And I think you'll like this last question. What is your favorite time signature?
Oh, goody. That's a nice one. You know what? I really like seven. I really like 7/8. I really like 7/8. It's still a lot of wind band conducting. There's not much. There's no British dance band music in 7/8. Not that I've found. Somebody will write in.
Yet.
Seven eight. I used to do a lot of wind band conducting, and in fact, still we're still really closely sort of associated with that band. And used to really like to play a lot of the more sort of contemporary stuff and commission a lot of stuff, and a lot of it would have either quite long passages of 7/8, or maybe just the odd sort of 7/8, just to break up the 4/4 or whatever. I like it because you never quite know with 7/8, do you? Is it a 2+2+3 or a 3+2+2 or a 2+3+2? You know, you never quite know, and it just gives that little. It's just that little sort of skip, isn't it, in the middle of it? And yeah, it's a 7/8, definitely.
Nice. I love that.
Good.
Great answer, Catherine. Well, it has been truly wonderful to have you on the podcast today. And thank you
It's
for
my
agreeing to come on.
pleasure.
And
Thank you.
I am looking forward to the book. And I would have thought, I don't know if you know, but Women in Jazz Media have another podcast called On the Bookcase.
Yes, I've seen this.
So maybe we'll have that on the bookcase. I don't run that podcast, but I will put it to them.
Oh, well, that'd be very nice. You've probably got a couple of years to think about it, so that's all right. Thank you.
Thank you again, and I hope you have a lovely research project.
Thank you very much, Hannah. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this podcast for Women in Jazz Media. We have a great back catalogue of podcasts with amazing women, including Claire Martin, OBE, Tatiana Gorolovsky, Esther Bennett, and many more. Please do check them out, and I'll see you at the next one. Bye!